This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 19th, 2009. In Cairo, I'm Ayad Batraoui, sitting in for Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, the Obama administration announces aggressive fuel efficiency standards. A federal investigation reveals abuse of children in U.S. schools. And we head to the West Bank, where a new Western-backed Palestinian government has been formed without Hamas. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today announced that the United States will provide $110 million in humanitarian support to Pakistan's citizens who've been forced from their homes by the military offensive against the Taliban in the Swat Valley. The aid package includes basic shelter supplies, non-perishable food items, and a provision to purchase locally produced food.
Providing this assistance is not only the right thing to do, but we believe it is essential to global security and the security of the United States. And we are prepared to do more as the situation demands.
Secretary Clinton also said the United States is helping Pakistan launch a text messaging system that will allow them to notify people about available relief programs and help families remain in contact. She also announced a texting method for those in the United States to donate to relief efforts.
Using your cell phones, Americans can text the word SWAT, S-W-A-T, to the number 20222 and make a $5 contribution that will help the UN High Commissioner for Refugees provide tents, clothing, food, and medicine to hundreds of thousands of affected people.
The number of people who've been uprooted by the fighting is estimated to be up to 2 million. More than 130,000 are staying in at least 22 relief camps. Scores of indigenous people have been killed in Colombia this year. Yesterday, Robert Huachita, a well-known leader of the Nasa Nation, became the second political leader to be assassinated in as many weeks. Manuel Rueda reports from Bogota.
Huachita was the vice governor of Honduras, a reservation in the southwestern Cauca province. He was beaten and shot by armed men who intercepted him on a country road. The Cauca Region Indigenous Council said that Huachita had received several death threats over the past 6 months. Council leader Aida Quilque spoke about the situation in Huachita's reservation.
That community has received many threatening text messages and some letters, too. There was an assassination attempt against one of the reservation's leaders last year, but fortunately he didn't die.
The Nasa people inhabit the western flank of the Andes Mountains, a territory that has been partly occupied by guerrilla groups who run cocaine labs in the area. Like many of his fellow tribesmen, Huachita opposed the rebels' drug trafficking activities. He was also critical of government plans to establish gold mines in the area. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
Sri Lanka's president has declared the country liberated from 3 decades of war against terrorism a day after the rebel leader was killed in the battlefield. Rebel leader Piribaharan was widely seen by Tamils as their only hope against discrimination and alleged human rights abuses by the majority Sinhala government. Ponia Manakavasagam.
As a long war has ended, President Mahinda Rajapaksa called on the people of the country to join hands to develop the nation.
Our aim was to liberate the Tamil people from the terrorism of the LTTE. Our war heroes have sacrificed their lives to save the innocent Tamil people. The victory we have achieved is a victory for the entire nation. It is a victory won by all in our motherland. It is my responsibility to protect all the Tamils living in this country.
But R. Sammandan, a prominent Tamil political party leader, says the president has failed to address the political remedy to the root cause of the problem. The UN had earlier estimated 50 to 100,000 civilians were trapped in the conflict zone. The government now says all the civilians have been rescued, but continued to deny humanitarian agencies entry into the conflict zone. The UN and the Red Cross have expressed concern over the hundreds of civilians wounded during the final bitter fighting and have made an urgent appeal for medical care for those wounded in the war. For FSRN, Ponnayamanika Vasagam, Sri Lanka.
And now a correction. In a report yesterday on fishermen protesting a pipeline in Brazil, we stated that a natural gas and petroleum deposit was found in the Guanabara Bay in January 2008. In fact, the natural gas and petroleum deposit is not located in the Guanabara Bay, but is 400 kilometers offshore. Free Speech Radio News sincerely regrets any misconception this may have created. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
President Barack Obama announced sweeping changes to mile per gallon standards. By 2016, passenger cars must get 39 miles per gallon and light trucks 30 miles per gallon. And for the first time, the president set federal tailpipe emission standards. The changes, according to Obama, will be equivalent to taking 177 million cars off the road over 6.5 years. Signaling widespread agreement to his plans, President Obama made the announcement in the Rose Garden, surrounded by heads of all major car companies and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California.
Even as views differ on many important issues, is that the status quo is no longer acceptable. While the United States makes up less than 5% of the world's population, we create roughly a quarter of the world's demand for oil. And this appetite comes at a tremendous price, the price measured by our vulnerability to volatile oil markets, which send gas prices soaring and families scrambling. It's measured by a trade deficit, where as much as 20% of what we spend on imports is spent on oil. It's measured in billions of dollars sent to oil exporting nations, many that we do not choose to support if we had a choice. It's measured in a changing climate, as sea levels rise and droughts spread, forest burns and storms rage.
California's support was crucial. The state sued to set their own more stringent limits, but has decided to drop the case because this new federal proposal meets its own higher standards. The agreement is also supported by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation, which must formally approve the new rule. However, there will be a cost, $1,300 per car, which could be passed on to the consumer. The administration says the cost will be a wash because of money saved in gas. And in the Senate, lawmakers passed legislation to overhaul what many call abusive practices by credit card companies. The measure will protect consumers against excessive fees and ill-timed increases on interest rates. Although consumer advocates say the legislation could have been stronger, they say it's a major win over the powerful banking lobby. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
When signing up for a credit card, rights are washed down the drain. Translated into layperson's terms, the small print says the credit card company can do whatever it wants, whenever it wants. That often means an unannounced increase in interest and excessive fees. But the Senate voted to stop those practices. Democratic Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut authored the legislation. He says consumers have won an important battle.
What happened today was, for the first time, really, we did something that directly affects millions of consumers across this country, and that is to provide relief from the abuses that have occurred in the credit card industry, particularly in the last several years.
Republican John Thune is one of five senators to oppose the legislation. His banking-friendly state of South Dakota is home to major credit card companies, including Citibank and Wells Fargo.
It's going to be really detrimental to a number of credit card issuers in South Dakota. So it's a kind of a home state vote.
The measure does several things. It prohibits a rate hike within a holder's first year. It also requires 45 days' notice before raising rates and only on future charges. Just as consumers with bad credit are punished with increased fees and interest rates, the credit card company must reduce fees for those following the rules. The terms of the agreement will have to be posted on the internet and billing statements sent out 21 days before the due date. The legislation also makes it more difficult for people under 21 to obtain credit cards. Consumer advocates say this bill is a great step forward. Bill Plunkett is with the Consumer Federation of America.
This is the most comprehensive piece of legislation ever to move in a body of Congress that reins in the tricks and the traps that credit card companies have been using for over 10 years.
The banking industry unsuccessfully lobbied against this legislation. They say the outcome will be restricted credit for some, annual fees for others, and increased rates for all. They did have one victory. They were able to defeat a proposal that would place a cap on interest rates. Without this cap, that means rates could rise above the current average of 13%. The House and the Senate must now reconcile the differences in the two versions of the bill before it heads to the president's desk for signature. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Government Accountability Office released a report that looks into the use of seclusion and restraints in schools. In some cases, these practices have led to excessive abuse of children by teachers and even death. Seclusion can include isolating a child for hours, and restraint can include holding a child face down to immobilize them. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
Managing Director of Investigations at the GAO, Greg Kutz, said the report looked at the current laws on the books for seclusion and restraints in schools. It was a short list.
There are no federal laws restricting the use of seclusion and restraint in public and private schools. At the state level, laws and regulations vary widely.
The Children's Health Act of 2000 says the use of seclusion and restraint can only be used for emergency situations for children in federally funded health care facilities. But there is no such restriction for schools. Again, Kutz.
We identified hundreds of allegations of the abusive use of seclusion and restraint in public and private schools. At least 20 of these cases resulted in death. Most of the allegations related to children with disabilities.
Tony Price's foster son, Cedric, was one of them. Cedric had behavioral problems, many which resolved around food. On one occasion, his teacher refused to give Cedric lunch for problems in the classroom and told him to sit down. Price said Cedric refused.
So the teacher forced him into his chair and restrained him. She is roughly 6 feet tall, weighs over 230 pounds. Cedric was short. He was a little boy. Cedric struggled as he was being held in a chair, so the teacher put him face down and sat on him. He struggled and said repeatedly, "I can't breathe. If you can talk, if you can speak, you can breathe," she snapped at him. Shortly after that, he stopped speaking and he stopped struggling and he stopped moving.
The GAO report says sometimes seclusion or restraints were used even when a child was not in danger to themselves and their parents had not given permission. Chair of the House Education Committee, George Miller, says there's a fine line on whether the practices should be used at all.
You know, we've been discussing a lot and listening to waterboarding, about waterboarding, where you drip water over a cloth on a person's face, they're upside down, I guess, and you create the perception that they're drowning. And you start to think of here, you're losing your breath, you're losing your ability to breathe. Ms. Price talked about Cedric trying to tell people that he couldn't breathe. So you're creating that same psychological impact on that child that they're going to suffocate. And even if you, quote, use it successfully, the fear, the humiliation that you've that child has experienced, it to me is almost incomprehensible that we would think that this is some kind of proper therapy to use on very young children.
Professor of Education at the University of Nebraska, Reese Peterson, testified at the hearing. He says schools can sometimes be caught in a catch-22. He recounts a case where a school had been sued because they had restrained a student who died.
But within a month or so, another school did not restrain a youngster who then ran out, fell into a river, and drowned. And in this case, the school was sued for not restraining. We don't want the situation where teachers can't touch kids at all, but some yet would consider any touching to be inappropriate whatsoever.
The GAO report looked at 10 specific cases of abuse and noted that staff were not often well trained in the use of restraint and seclusion techniques. Committee members took suggestions from those who testified on creating national standards for seclusion and restraints, increasing training and staffing for teachers, and creating a database to inform school districts if a teacher had been involved with any type of seclusion or restraint abuse. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Today is a global day of action in support of Troy Anthony Davis. He's been on Georgia's death row for 18 years after a jury convicted him in 1991 of the murder of Savannah police officer Mark McPhail. But Davis has always maintained his innocence. Last month, in a 2-1 decision, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Georgia denied Davis's petition, and just last week, his 30-day stay of execution to temporarily suspend the execution ended. FSRN's Saki Hall reports from Atlanta.
Events for the Troy Davis Global Day of Action are scheduled in all 50 states and in 20 states around the world, in countries like Argentina, France, and Uganda. Having faced execution 3 times, and now possibly a 4th, it has been a trying time for Davis and his family. Despite this, his sister Martina Correa says Davis is excited about the Global Day of Action, and they both are thankful for the support.
Someone had sent me an email from Israel, and they said, "I'm not an activist. I've never been involved in human rights work because of where I'm from and what I've had to see growing up as a child. But I've never seen a case so outrageous in all of my life. And that's why I'm going to rallies in Washington, D.C. and fighting for Troy Anthony Davis." People all over the world, the European Union, the Council of Europe, people who support the death penalty are saying this is wrong.
Laura Moy is the deputy director of Amnesty International's Southern Region. Having worked on Davis's case for the past 2 years, she describes it as a tremendous journey.
To see the number of people who are willing to come out and do something, to know that over 500,000 people have signed the petition, I mean, that is incredibly heartening. So we've got to keep our hope up. We've got to keep the mobilizing up because his life depends on it.
The state's case against Troy Davis relied heavily on eyewitness testimony since there was no physical evidence and the murder weapon was never found. After the conviction, 7 of the 9 witnesses recanted or changed their testimony. Since then, 9 new people have come forward to accuse Sylvester Coles of committing the murder. Coles is the original witness to finger Davis. An evidentiary hearing would allow witnesses to be heard in court, but Davis's petition has been denied at every level. His lawyers are filing a new petition to the U.S. Supreme Court. But given the track record of the appeal so far, activists are not relying on the court. Tuesday's day of action will include rallies, vigils, letter writing, text messaging, and petition drives to raise awareness and pressure authorities like the governor of Georgia to intervene. Again, Laura Moy.
We're trying to generate that kind of public spotlight of attention and pressure to give folks who might be willing to do the right thing the political cover they need, and also to know that we're going to hold them accountable, that we don't accept the technicalities and the, you know, the excuses that have been given so far to not let Troy be able to get the new evidence back into a court of law.
Ajamu Baraka, executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, is a longtime anti-death penalty activist. He says it is important to raise the case of Troy Davis because it highlights the continued contradictions regarding the death penalty in the U.S. He sees mobilizations like the Day of Action as vital in the fight against the death penalty.
It's important that the policymakers here in Georgia, and in particular the Board of Pardons and Parole, understand that the citizens of this state are no longer in support of this ultimate violation of human rights.
Since the temporary halt on the execution has expired, a new date could be scheduled at any time. Amnesty International's USA hopes their call for a global day of action will lead Georgia and Washington, D.C. to take a second look. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Atlanta.
And now on to Nigeria, where a major military operation aimed at insurgents is underway in the country's Niger Delta region.
Residents fleeing the area are reporting a high death toll as entire villages are being bombarded by land, sea, and air. The insurgents have retaliated by destroying two major oil and gas pipelines. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Thousands of government ground troops, backed by warships and helicopters, are taking part in the operation which started last Friday. The attacks have been concentrated in and around the Gbaramatu Kingdom of Delta State. The main militant group in the region, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, has a camp in the area. The Ijaw National Congress, the umbrella body of the Ijaw ethnic group whose villages are being attacked, say about 1,000 people have been killed since Friday. Amagbe Ketebe is an official of the body.
In terms of casualties, as of last count for us here, and this keeps escalating because the war is still going on, the killing is still going on. As of the last count, we have had almost 1,000 people have been said to be killed. The civilians are being killed. So we're calling first and foremost for a stop to this.
While the military has not confirmed the death toll, the Nigerian media puts the figure at about 400. There are also reports that many villages have been completely destroyed.
Villages were leveled. As of this afternoon, there's some certain areas that have been completely leveled. And that means the military had come in, they bombarded from the air, they came from the sea, they came from all over, and our people had to virtually retreat into the forest.
Speaking at a news conference, military spokesperson Colonel Chris Jemitola says the military action is to, among other things, to protect oil installations and stop militants from attacking soldiers serving in the JTF, a special unit operating in the Niger Delta. He said the operation is not aimed at civilians.
What we have observed is the deliberate and repeated unprovoked attacks on JTF, the sabotage of oil and gas facilities. These are all acts of criminality that cannot be condoned by any government, and no responsible military leadership will fold its arms and watch its personnel attacked and killed while on official assignments by any criminal gangs.
Virtually all of Nigeria's crude oil comes from the region. The militants took up arms 5 years ago to demand local control of crude oil proceeds, which is mainly shared between the Nigerian government and Western oil companies. The military action reflects a deepening of the crisis over control of crude oil resources in the Niger Delta. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
And today, the Palestinian Prime Minister Sanam Fayyad and his new government were sworn in following meetings in Cairo among Palestinian factions that are yet to produce a national unity deal. Under the new government, 10 of the 23 ministers are Fatah members and the remaining belong to other groups, but none to Hamas, which said it would not recognize the new government. FSRN's Ghassan Banoura has more on this.
Prime Minister Fayyad and his ministers were sworn in by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah on Tuesday evening before President Abbas was scheduled to leave for the US to meet President Obama. The new government includes 4 female ministers, and 10 of the 23 ministers are Fatah members, but there are no representatives of Hamas. The Western-backed Dr. Fayyad had no approval of any Palestinian political group. Nassar Ibrahim, a Palestinian political analyst, says the new government marks a failure in the internal Palestinian dialogue.
This means that the talks between Fatah and Hamas and the rest of the Palestinian parties in Cairo did not accomplish any results, and now we're back to the starting point. Two governments, one in the West Bank and the other in Gaza, and each control their own area.
Hamas wants a power-sharing government that does not have a specific agenda, while Fatah insists that any agreement between the two parties should be based on Hamas's acceptance of Bas-signed peace agreements between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, godfather of the Palestinian National Authority. Since coming to power after January 2006 elections, Hamas has shunned peace talks with Israel until the occupation of the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem and the West Bank comes to an end. Fatah officials say the new government will not have any effect on the Palestinian internal talks. Faiz Assaka, a Palestinian parliamentarian from Fatah.
This government will not stop or boost the internal talks. This is a caretaker government only.
Whether Palestinian factions approve or not, the new government of Dr. Salam Fayyad will have to deal with major obstacles: the Israeli settlement's expansion in the West Bank, a division between the West Bank and Gaza, and the stalemate peace process. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
Aside from the death and violence that Palestinian residents faced during and after Israel's recent war on the Gaza Strip, new information indicates that Israeli soldiers also looted goods. The Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights says that more than a dozen Palestinians had their money or jewelry robbed, as well as their credit cards, which may have been used later by Israeli soldiers. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has this story from Gaza.
Ahmed Rafia is a 25-year-old man who says he lost 1,600 shekels, or about $400.
We were displaced for about 2.5 weeks at the UNRWA-run schools. When we returned back home, we saw there was a lot of damage. I searched for my things, and it looked like my bank card was lost. Then I headed for the bank to withdraw money, but the bank officer checked the computer and said to my surprise that my money had been withdrawn by an Israeli soldier at the Israeli Bank of Mizrahi.
Ahmed filed a complaint with the Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights. His is one of at least 15 other cases in which Gaza residents had their cash, jewelry, or bank cards stolen. People accuse Israeli soldiers of the thefts during the January attacks on the region. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has filed the robbery complaints with Israeli justice system, but the center says it does not trust Israeli law. Jaber Ushah is the deputy director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza.
Due to this lack of faith in the Israeli jurisdiction, we now go directly into international universal jurisdiction in some states, which their systems allow to sue suspected war criminals in committing war crimes or crimes against humanity, even if the victim is not one of the country's citizen and the crime was not committed on the land of the same country.
According to Haaretz, the Israeli military police are currently investigating a series of robberies and assaults by Israeli soldiers during the wartime period. However, the Israeli military general prosecutor recently halted investigations into Israeli army human rights violations in Gaza during the three-week-long Israeli attacks that ended January 18th. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editor is Nell Abram. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katapchi, and Oscar Hernandez. In Cairo, I'm A.L. Batraoui, sitting in for Aura Bugado.